Hey listeners, presumably you've had time to calm down since the Festival of Fun that was our congregation upon York last week. It's back to good old Skype communications this week, so apologies for any reduction in sound quality, but get over it. As always, I am Craig from oneliner.com, and joining me from Glasgow is Scott Morris.
Hello.
And from Sunny Falkirk, Drew Tavendale.
How do you?
Nothing much changes there then. Will the films provide any variety for us tonight? Let's have a peek inside. Never having seen any of the franchise so far, I'm perhaps the last person you want to ask about installment 4 of the Fast and the Furious saga, this time provocatively titled Fast and Furious. What I do know is that Maverick cop Brian O'Connor is now working for the FBI, presumably because he's just so damn good at driving and stuff, and has lately found himself forced to team up with old adversary Dominic Toretto. Why? Because an acquaintance of Dominic's has been murdered, and, conveniently, the killers are tied in with heroin traffickers of whom Brian is in hot pursuit. Fans of the series will no doubt know what to expect, and this time they are being lured in with the promise of a reassembled cast from the original installment. Now, on my planet, the promise of Vin Diesel, Paul Walker, Michelle Rodriguez and Jordana Brewster together on film sounds more like a thinly veiled threat, but I know one souped-up race-ready mofo who will put the record straight, and that mofo is Drew.
Yes, and talking of setting records straight, I think you might want to revise Maverick cop Brian O'Connor to crap cop Brian O'Connor, which fit nicely with the Paul Walker's acting ability. Just a point before telling anything about the film is that apparently the producers have decided that this is should be as confusingly named as possible. The first film, The Fast and the Furious, with Vin Diesel, Paul Walker, Jordana Brewster, Michelle Rodriguez, they make a new film with this original cast and just remove the word "the."
So no definite article then? Is that the only difference?
That's significant enough, and that won't cause any problems at all should anybody want to be buying the DVD of it and searching for it.
Or wondering why they've got a free fourth disc when they buy the trilogy box set that seems to be a duplicate of the first.
Yes. Having said that, it's not as awful a film as you might expect. The second film, particularly in the series, was actually really quite enjoyable, as you might know if you've read Scott's review of it. This is despite Paul Walker. This installment has less Eva Mendes, unfortunately,
yes,
but also a bit less Paul Walker, so that's to be commended. And while it does have Vin Diesel, I've never thought much of Vin Diesel's acting ability, but...
What?
Have I shocked you?
take this letter. It's for my dad.
Sorry. That was startlingly close to Tom Noonan in Manhunt. Not Manhunter. And not Tom Noonan, even.
So what you said was that was a bit like Somebody and Something.
Yes. I was going to say, Hannibal Lecter's in them both. I was going to say it was startlingly close to, it puts the lotion on its skin or else it gets to hose again. Hey, maybe I found some sort of link. Sorry, I digress.
Oh, yeah. Ted Levine is in the first Fast and Furious film, so.
Is he?
It was a very, very tenuous link, yeah.
Holy smoke. Ted Levine. Of whom my impersonation sounds startlingly like my impersonation of Vin Diesel in Saving Private Ryan together in the same film franchise. It's like the Da Vinci Code for sun readers.
I thought the Da Vinci Code was for sun readers.
Oh, shit. But we digress.
Yeah.
Sorry, you were saying something about some bloke in a shit car.
No, I was just saying Vin Diesel, I've never thought much of his acting ability, unsurprisingly. I've never found them an unlikable person on screen. I suppose, like, be better acting, please. But I've never thought, get off my screen now, as I so often have with other people. So with that in mind, I mean, I can at least find them likable enough to care what happens to them to a degree. And you've actually thrown me off. I've no idea what I wanted to say now.
Does it have powers in it, Drew?
Well, that's the really weird thing. It's an alright film. I wasn't bored through it, which I was expecting to have been. I like the fact it did actually have less lines for Paul Walker to say, which has got to be a good thing.
I like the fact that in reading the IMDb synopsis, because I haven't seen the film, obviously, I don't see many films these days for someone who introduces a film review podcast, but I like the Scooby-Doo aspect of the mystery, which leads Vin Diesel's character onto the heroin traffickers, and that at the scene of the murder of his acquaintance, who shan't be named for plot reasons, he finds a particular brand, traces of a residue of a particular type of nitrous, which is only sold at one body shop in LA.
Yes, If you started to think about it at all, which really there's no need to do, it starts falling apart spectacularly, because despite having been an exile from the United States for several years, he seems to still know exactly everything that's happening in the street racing scene in Los Angeles.
I want to know what car body shop it is that has its own chemical processing plant.
Yeah, well, the stuff is called nitro meth, which sounds more like a flavour of a smokable drug than something in your car.
Nitro meth is something that Scottish hobos particularly like to drink from knocked to blutered in 6 seconds.
A fortified nitrous.
Oh my goodness, this review is going to pot. Drew, is it any good?
Oh, so as I was saying, yeah, it's all
no,
right.
No, listen, it's got cars in it. Is it any good?
Oh, that's
a bit reductivist, isn't it?
Sorry, but we're losing the reins on this one here. It's either you spend ages editing it into something vaguely comprehensible, or we nip the fucker in the bud now.
Take it out.
Shall I finish what I was going to say?
No! It's got cars and that in it. Is it any good?
I'll finish what I'm going to say and ignore you anyway.
Oh, why do I bother?
I don't know. Stop. I only wanted to say a couple of sentences, but it's taken 10 minutes because somebody keeps interrupting me.
Say the man.
Oh, I'm just going to say, it's gone down the strange route of deciding that for a film about cars, it needs a bit fewer cars and more silly revenge plot lines. But it's in a switch your brain off way, it's reasonably enjoyable. Could do with a few more car chases, and I think fans of the series will like it. I can't recommend it particularly highly. But if you're
a car chase movie that comes up short in car chases, then
yes, possibly a bit of a fatal flaw there. But there are a few decent car chases, some nice stunt driving, which is
good.
Yeah, it's all right. I wasn't bored. Just reasonably enjoyable if you don't think about it too much. yeah, if you've seen the other films, I'll be saying about a lot of films recently.
Right, apparently Lord Piccolo wants to rule the world using 7 Dragon Balls. Quite how the dragons feel about their castration being seized upon to such nefarious ends is a matter for those more in the know than I, but I digress. Goku, remember him, has to stop Piccolo at the request of his grandfather, owner of 1 Dragon Ball, and whose life the Evil Lord has recently extinguished. If you are 10 years old and male, you stand a very good chance of understanding this. However, as a 226-year-old hermaphrodite, I cannot possibly begin to fathom the indecipherably complex socio-political undercurrents that this gentle melodrama explores in contemplative fashion. So I shall hand over to my compatriots. Or should I say, I'm guessing compatriot, because Drew, you haven't seen this, have you?
Certainly not.
No. Scott, share your pain.
You could say I was pleasantly surprised by Dragon Ball Evolution, but that would be something of a lie. It's
so you couldn't say it at all.
It's not as offensive as I thought it would be. It just has the unmistakable taint of a film that really has nothing to do with me. I don't know anything about Dragon Ball apart from some very poor Mega Drive beat-em-up from back in the day, which wasn't very good, and the series, I understand, isn't much more clever than that. This gives it a sort of X-Men-ish, leather-clad, high-tech gloss-over compared to the somewhat more mundane original, and it's not terrible, to be brutally honest. It's just a film that has no relevance to anyone over the age of about 13, 14, maybe, at a stretch. It's got some reasonably competent action scenes and some reasonably competent CG and some reasonably competent acting, and it's not a god-awful film. It's just the sort of thing that you will have seen umpteen million times before if you have any sort of experience in cinema going. For the younger, perhaps more unrefined palates of people who haven't been exposed to as much cinema, as much Hong Kong cinema and all that sort of stuff, it'll probably be reasonably acceptable. I've no real bones to pick with it. I'm not going to sit and pillory it for not appealing to someone who it's clearly not supposed to appeal to. It's not really designed with a 30-year-old in mind. It's designed with a 13-year-old in mind. And I think for those guys, it's...
Thank God you're not 30 yet, Scott.
Near enough. I suppose the only depressing thing about the film is Chow Yun-Fat is in it, and Chow Yun-Fat is... Well, he's went from being something of a legend to someone who appears to be starring in anything for loose change. For someone who I used to hold in such awe back in the John Woo days, seeing him sort of just show up and say a few lines and go home. And he's fine in this. The acting throughout is fairly reasonable, and he's certainly by no means the worst. He's still fairly charismatic, but I just think that the man ought to be doing something better. It's tragic that the best thing that Hollywood can come up for him is bloody Bulletproof Monk. There's just something wrong with that scenario, but that's an old story. This doesn't change it in any way. It's not a terrible film if you're 13, I would imagine. It's just not a film that is of any real relevance to guys like us.
Well, on that bombshell. In I Love You, Man, Paul Rudd is Peter Klavan, a friendless fellow who, his marriage imminent, suddenly realises he has no best man to call upon. Peter embarks on a series of fruitless mandates before happening upon and instantly bonding with Sidney Fife, played by forgetting Sarah Marshall's Jason Segel. As the two bond in blokey fashion, Peter finds his relationship with fiancée Zoe, Rashida Jones, increasingly strained, and finds himself faced with a choice between wife and new best friend. Co-written and directed by John Hamburg of Along Came Polly and Zoolander fame, I Love You Man sounds like it's aiming for the Judd Apatow fans, but does it live up to expectation? Drew, what would be your summation?
I would just like to say, though, that this film uses a phrase you used there a lot, which I just hate, it's just mandate, and also... Mm. Romance. It's like, where I come from, it's largely just going out for a drink with a friend. I'm not quite sure why he needs a special name, and why. Anyway, yes, I'll save that rant for another time. I could be here sometime. It's definitely got an Apatow-ish sort of feel to it, this film. So you'd be right there. It's not surprisingly, I suspect, not quite as good as an Apatow film, but it's reasonable. Paul Rudd is typically likable and a good supporting cast. The likes of Jon Favreau is a very, very grumpy man that's played quite well. It's just that it's in no way surprising what happens plot-wise, and there's just a few irritating moments in it where, for some reason, Paul Rudd gets very, very nervous when he's meeting his new best friend and not having spent much time with male friends, and starts saying really silly things at the end of sentences, which is mildly amusing to begin with. It is, yes, we'll be there, totally, totes my goats. Sort of daft words that might amuse me for a bit.
Totes my goats.
Totes my goats. Yeah, totally. Totes my goats.
That does sound kind of funny, actually.
Well, that's a thing that amuses me in small doses, because it starts to become wearing quite quickly. By the end of the film, it's just very, very tiresome.
Totes my goats.
Someone walking about cradling a goat.
There are a few good things. I don't know. A strange running joke about every accent that Paul Rudd tries to do sounding like a leprechaun, regardless of country. It's unpredictable, but the characters and the actors likeable enough. The chemistry between the two leads is quite compelling. There are only a few laugh out loud moments, but quite a reasonable number of warm chuckles throughout it. It's not a bad film at all. It is, however, guilty of a near unforgivable crime, and that's the complete waste of the ever-brilliant J.K. Simmons, who, for the first time I've seen him in years, is, in the very brief moments on the screen, not given any of the type of lines with which he normally steals the scene. And I just... How can you waste J.K. Simmons? Not quite sure that's possible.
Or have we got our definitions of waste mixed up? Oh, I think I'm so gangster.
Yeah, that's always been my one criticism of you, Craig. You're just too gangster.
Yep. Damn skippity. Carry on.
With what? I'm finished.
Oh, all right.
There wasn't really anything more to say.
That's your summation of it. Not go and see it, don't go and see it. Just, they waste J.K. Simmons on it.
I already summed it up. I said it was a fairly decent film.
That's the kind of startlingly insightful commentary you tune into this podcast for. Scott, what did you think?
I've not seen it, and I'm going to have a beer.
Ladies and gentlemen, now follows exaltation from Armenian Tractor Factory on situation of Ben Kingsley film. Thank you.
The name Ben Kingsley is truly the harbinger of a binary outcome. Either exultation or derision will surely follow. In 50 Dead Men Walking, he somewhat reassuringly plays second fiddle to Jim Sturgess, here portraying Martin McGartland, upon whose experiences the film is based. As a young man in Northern Ireland, McGartland was courted by the Provisional IRA, but found himself at odds with their use of cruel punishments and killings, instead opting to work as a mole for the British police. Eventually rumbled, McGartland was subject to horrendous torture and escaped only by throwing himself out of the window of a high-rise building. Still in hiding to this day, McGartland's story is surely a gripping one, but does the film adaptation do his trials and tribulations justice? Scott?
Okay, usual disclaimer, based on a true story, for given values of true. That said, it's still quite likeable. There's not much more at the plot than has already been said, but at least it doesn't pull its punches. It does show off that the IRA were not freedom fighters, as it was continually claimed largely by Sinn Féin fundraisers in the US. They were just murdering cunts. At least shows that off relatively well. It is fairly well acted by pretty much everyone. Thankfully, it is Ben Kingsley on somewhat decent form, rather than his run of The Love Guru and things would harvenge.
Well, the last thing, apart from The Love Guru, it was in the Wackness quite recently, so
there
have been more promising signs of late.
It is fine. I have no real issues with this film. It's perfectly acceptable. I quite enjoyed it. The only problem I've got with it is that I have seen this film so many times before, because in execution and tone and style, it is exactly the same as every other undercover cop going into some gang scenario that you've ever seen. This one just happens to have an Irish brogue labelled over the top of it. That doesn't make it a bad film, but it does make it a film that I feel I've seen an awful lot of in the past umpteen years, and it doesn't do an awful lot to distinguish itself from the herd. That said, it's still a reasonable enough example of type, and I've fairly enjoyed it.
Funky. Drew, did you have anything to add to that?
No, that's a good word Scottish used there. Fine. It's all right. I mean, apart from Rose McGowan, who blissfully isn't in it much, the performances are pretty solid all round. It's probably something to fall into more worthy but dull, because it's just not the most compelling story. I suspect a good documentary and it would be more interesting. But yeah, it's sort of enlightening at some points. But again, yeah, but it's something I feel like I have seen before. It feels particularly in tone like a film from 2004 called El Lobo, about an undercover agent working in ETA. And that, so watching, I'm thinking, yeah, I've seen it, like Scott's saying, seen it before several times, but very.
Didn't that have a musical based sequel called Los Lobos?
That's the one, yep. Yeah, so much more to say than that. The performances are solid. It's a worthy film, it's just not particularly compelling. I didn't know that much about the story beforehand and deliberately not tried to find out anything, but it begins with showing Martin of being shot, so therefore any point later on there's no tension because you know he's going to get out of it, because it started off with a scene set after the rest of the film, which is rather foolish, I think.
Yeah, the fact he's still alive to write about it as well, something of a clue perhaps, but
yeah, but again, I didn't actually know that, because I deliberately tried to find out as much as, or find out as little as possible rather, but then you get that opening scene and it's like, oh right then.
Oh, there we go then. 50 Dead Men Walking. Certainly not worth going out of your way to avoid. Let the Right One In has gathered quite some momentum on the festival circuit. Hell, if Harry Knowles says it was the best film he saw last year, then it must be the big I Am, mustn't it? Oh, if Jabba the Hutt chuckled about it, then hell. The product of Swedish director Thomas Aldridsson, and based on author John Lundquist's novel of the same name, it's the story of a young boy called Oscar who is bullied at school, forging a friendship with outcast girl Ely, who, it turns out, is not only a bit odd, but also a vampire. Not without his gory moments, Let the Right One In is also billed as a tender relationship drama. It's just that most of us will go to see it for the gory bits. Is it any good, though? Drew?
Nah.
No.
First of all, I'd say it's not a vampire film. It's a relationship story that happens to have some vampires in it.
As you do.
And certainly that might make you think of Twilight, which was a turgid relationship drama that had some vampires in it, which was entirely irrelevant to the story. And fortunately, it's not that bad, though that could very much be considered to be damning with faint praise. I just found it really rather dull. The pacing is pedestrian, to say the least, and there's just not an awful lot happens, and then it ends. What more can I say?
Thanks for that.
It's the main character, Oscar, kind of creepy little kid, but not in a particularly unlikable way. It's more just there.
She's more just Swedish.
I just found it difficult to care about any of the characters or what was happening, and got mildly annoyed by the fact the few bits of violence of our feature, the apparently necessary orchestral stab when the attack happens. But
my pet hate.
I didn't do anything for me, I'm afraid.
Scott, did you find any more enjoyment?
To be honest, I quite liked it. Something of a taxonomical nightmare, because it's only very nominally a horror film. It's a horror film on the basis that it happens to have a vampire in it, but it's a vampire film in the same way that Brokeback Mountain is a gay film. It's not. It's a love story that just happens to have a vampire and some maulings in it. Yeah, it's basically a relationship drama. I thought it was reasonably well acted. Its pacing is slow, but it's kind of the point of it. It's all very bleak, and it's something to do with the kind of snowbound scenario. It sort of reminds me a bit of 30 Days of Night. It's not quite as good as that. I don't think it's quite as good as the reputation that it has deserves, but I think it's definitely worth a look. There's some pretty decent effects during the gore and some strange things. Lots of it's quite subtle, it's quite underplayed. It's not completely in your face about having vampires all about the time. It's not one of these vampire films like Underworld or that, which is basically set around going, ooh, big long tracking shots of vampires doing sexy things because they're vampires and are sexy. It's almost irrelevant to the film that it happens to have vampires in it, apart from the odd killing to slake Ellie's bloodthirst. Yeah, to be honest, I've no real complaints with it. I quite enjoyed it. I would not say it's the best film of any year, but it may well be the best horror film of the year, although that just makes it the only good fish in a very shitty pond.
I assume you certainly wouldn't want to see it remade by Hollywood and released in cinemas as early as next year, would you?
It would seem somewhat pointless, yes.
Oh, well, never mind. So does that basically, on the grounds that the rest of this evening's podcast has been so mediocre, make it your film recommendation of the week?
It is so far, but you've not finished.
Oh shit, neither I have. Neither I have, because I haven't prepared notes for two other films. Scott, why don't you fill us in on Armando Iannucci's In the Loop?
Right. Armando Iannucci is something of a personal hero of mine. If there's been any British comedy made in the last, well, as long as I've been alive, there's a better than evens chance that Armando Iannucci will have either directed it, wrote it, starred in it, or produced it. So I was quite looking forward to this. It's based on his excellent TV show, Joe the Thick of It. It pushes it a bit further, but it doesn't require any previous knowledge of it. Tom Hollander takes over the sort of ineffectual minister role, playing Simon Foster, and Peter Capaldi returns as the excellently sweary director of communications, Malcolm Tucker. It's set in the build-up to a war that is quite clearly the Iraq War, although I don't think it's ever actually mentioned, but it's not particularly subtle in that respect. Foster makes some somewhat ambiguous statements on the radio that could be seen as supporting or downplaying the possibility of a war starting, which turns him into a pawn in the middle of a transatlantic chess game between some Cheney-esque war hawks and those based in the more troublesome fact-based reality that know that there's no way to adequately support such a war. Now, the only problem I had going into this film, the only sort of slight reservation I had about thinking of it, was that some of Iannucci's stuff tends to be a little bit dry. It's often his kind of surreal flights of fancy that sort of give it a bit of pep to kind of alleviate some of the satire that he normally comes up with, and I thought that might be an issue, sort of sustaining it over 90 minutes. But thankfully it's not. It does still have some fairly biting satire and some fairly strong and damning things to say about the governmental process and the lead up to the wars, but it's quite effectively obscured by some quite amazingly innovative swearing. I have never heard language used as such a... It's just a bludgeon where you're getting hit over the head for 90 minutes with this just torrent of abuse, and it's fantastic.
It's actually, it's well over 100 minutes of film, so it's even more swearing. It just doesn't feel like it. Yeah, it's a swearing and insult tour de force. And really, I always want to go back and see it again myself with a notebook just so I can steal all the great insults.
That's the thing, it's layered. It's layered levels of profanity. You can't possibly take in all of the insult and horror in one sitting. You've got to go back and see it again.
Just yeah, subtle depths of fuckiness.
Yeah, well, yeah. It is the sort of film, the first 5 minutes, Tucker signs off of a phone call by saying, fuckity bye. And so if that's the sort of thing it's going to appeal to, and I take it that...
Yes, it is.
You're going to love this film. I don't want to labour it too much. It's not just funny because of swearing. It has some very deeply amusing bits. There's some great comedy in it. The actors in it, Tom Hollander, even Chris Addison, Peter Capaldi, have just such fantastic expressions and can pull away with so much. And obviously you don't need to know much about James Gandolfini's chops to know that he's going to be not going to disgrace himself. It's fantastically performed, and there's some great kind of just sort of facial expression comedy more than anything else. It does have layers of subtlety. It's not just about swearing, but...
It does help.
The use of language in it is just fantastic, and it's a major selling point. It's a hilarious film. Yeah, there's possibly only one other film I've laughed so much at this year. It's quite easily going to go on the top 10 lists. I can't see anything knocking it off. It was fantastic. I heartily recommend it to anyone with even the slightest interest in politics.
Cool. Well, hopefully I'll get a chance to catch up with that this weekend. But just say, for example, I wasn't able to get into a screening of In the Loop and I suddenly found myself with a desire to watch Jason Statham electrocute himself quite frequently. Drew, is there anything in the cinema right now that could help me out there?
There is this film called Crank High Voltage that may fix you, may provide you with a Statham fix.
Is there?
Would that be the sort of thing you'd want?
Well, I don't know, Drew. Tell me what's in it and I'll tell you.
This... was something I was not looking forward to. I haven't seen the first one. I intend to remedy that soon.
Yes.
I was not looking forward. The trailers looked really, really stupid. The cinema, everybody's in it. It's the first time I saw
them. Really, really stupid. They're not wrong then.
I remember everybody in the cinema that I was in when I first saw the trailer laughing at the stupidity of it. So I wasn't looking forward to it at all. But I went in, and if you're not sure of the premise, this very, very strong, resilient man called Chev Chelios, played by the Stath, or these big baldy head.
Who is, can we just point out, not the guy.
Carry on.
This Chev Chelios fella falls out of a helicopter, which is apparently the end of the first film.
Yep.
Picks up from there, lands in the middle of a road, is scooped up by some Chinese fellas, taken to a hidden secret clinic, and has his heart removed to give to some old bloke who's dying, some old Chinese triad. So the Stath is instead left with an artificial heart and a battery pack, which after he busts out of hospital on his way to get his heart back in his body, it malfunctions, and largely he's got to spend the rest of the film trying to get electricity into his body in as many ridiculous ways as possible.
I take it this is a kind of film where we shouldn't ask too many questions about how this triad gang have a battery-powered heart replacement that no hospital on earth has seen yet, and also why they would bother being so gracious as to give him that when he was already dead.
It's actually explained, though, because they want to keep the rest of his body alive because they're going to harvest the rest of him, including his schlong, which is apparently the tipping point that brings him out of his semi-coma.
I should have guessed. I love the fact... after falling something like 80 stories out of a helicopter onto a road, he's just in a coma.
As the tagline says, he was dead, he got better.
He got better, yeah. That's fair enough.
Okay, and that sounds really, really stupid. And the thing is, it is really, really stupid, but that's why it's so good, because much to my surprise, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's the stupidest thing I've seen in years, and it's one of the most entertaining films I've seen this year. I probably didn't stop laughing throughout, apart from one one point dipped very slightly. It's really stupid, but it knows it's really stupid. It uses all sort of daft devices and amusing visual styles and some quite entertaining swearing that almost could be good enough to make it into In the Loop. And it's just, it's just incredibly entertaining because it's so silly, but knows it is and seems to hit its marks just right. That you're just going to be hugely entertained by it.
I have to say the first film was quite entertaining. I didn't rate it as highly, but I mean from the looks of the trailer for Crank High Voltage, I'm going to have to go and see it because it looks like it's distilled it has, in the trailer alone, distilled everything from the first movie, all of that stupidity, into just a handful of clips. So I can only imagine what the rest of the film is going to be like. Scott, is it worth checking out?
Very much takes Crank 1's stupid ball and runs with it. In fact, it raises the stupid bar so high, I'm not even sure there is a stupid bar anymore. Yeah, it is great. I actually wound up watching Crank 1 for the first time and Crank 2 in the same day. I thought the last 10 minutes or so of Crank 2 kind of tailed off a bit, but that may just be because I've seen so much stupidity in one day. There's limits to what the human brain can take.
I'm surprised neither of you had seen the first one. I don't remember you never having seen it.
No, it just kind of passed me by. I'm not quite sure why, and I'm normally a big fan of Statham and his big bald head. But this was...
I miss his dodgy accents, though.
That's true, that's true. And you think with Chev Chelios, it was a grand opportunity for at least some silly accent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, whether or not the energy divides amongst the survivors.
You took the words out of my mouth.
I would compare it in the same way as Rush Hour 1 and 2. Rush Hour 2 is, despite what everyone else will tell you, a better film than Rush Hour 1 because it takes everything that Rush Hour 1 has and just cranks it up a bit. This is the same film. If you do want to make any criticism of it, then it is really just pulling the same stunts as the first one did. However, it does them better and it does them funnier.
Can't really ask for more than that.
Exactly. It is the sort of film within the first 10 minutes or so where the Staith has lubed up a shotgun and inserted it into someone's orifice.
Exactly. I kind of him to lube it up first.
I thought it was somewhat charming of him. It's just this insane parody of all action films that have gone before it, with some just downright bizarre moments, like where he tries to steal the electric shock collar off a dog and some couple walking the dog, and then he straps the shock collar around his neck, and then to get the owners of the shock collar to shock him, he just walks up to them and starts barking and roughing at them. There's some very strange and surreal moments in there, but they all work fantastically well. I laughed like a drain throughout. It's just a fantastically enjoyable film. It's perhaps not the sort of film that sophisticated urbanites like ourselves are supposed to like, but fuck that, it's great. I loved it.
Excellent. So, this week's podcast seems to have redeemed itself somewhat towards the end there. That's an excellent choice to have to make, isn't it? Am I in a inventive yet provocative sweary mood, or am I in a daft violent sweary mood? All bases are covered.
Yeah.
All bases are covered by two screens. I'm going to have to check out Crank High Voltage as well, because the first one was a bit of a gift, and I'm guessing the second one will probably be even more so. There you have it, guys. Thanks for bearing with us for another week. We will hopefully be back with you soon with reviews of what exactly are we going to be looking at next time? Do we know?
State of play, I would imagine.
Yeah.
State of play, at least. Report, certainly. Another Seth Rogen film. Uninvited, I think we may dodge.
No, I'll be watching The Uninvited and Outlander on my jaunt to Armenia, I believe. So that will cover those two.
Why? Well, why The Uninvited anyway?
It must be done.
Why not you make time for the tractor information film, Scott?
I like tractors. Tractors are good.
But we know which country makes the best.
Glorious Republic of Armenia.
Assuming that Scott makes it back from Armenia and he isn't framed for smuggling exotic tractor parts back out of the country, we will hopefully be with you in about a fortnight, guys. And we'll have all manner of exciting cinema goodness to refer unto you. Until then, I have been Craig and Scott has been Scott.
Goodbye, comrade.
And Drew has been Drew.
Fuckity bye.
Much great make, love the tractor. Goodbye.
And this is because of
toads, my god.